Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, February 16th, 2012. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, our theme is permission to live, the power of dealing with the dangerous parts of your life. And I would say nothing is more dangerous than contemplating yourself becoming incapacitated. The power of dealing with these kinds of things is that once you've got a good plan finished and in place, it's very freeing. You give yourself permission to live. I'm a person who spent a significant amount of times in my life with very powerful evidence to support the notion that I would be dead in anywhere from 10 seconds to 24 hours. It's been more than a few occasions. And through that process, somehow death and I have become friends. And the result has been a kind of freedom to live the purpose I most want and a joy in life that is quite freeing. And I would be very pleased if tonight's Solari Report contributes to your gift to give yourself the permission, your permission to live. Money and markets. There's one story this week that is coming through in story after story, and yet many of us look at those stories as being different stories, and they're not. They're one story. And I want to connect the dots and have you view them and be able to view them, because it's an evolving story. We're going to be watching this story for 5 to 10 years. And it's the story of the shift in global governance out of sovereign nation governments and sovereign municipal governments too, and into corporations. And so we're watching a huge reengineering happen. One of my most popular blog posts is Financial Coup d'etat. If you do a search for it, you'll pick it up quickly, either on the blog or in any search engine. Just put financial coup d'etat or put that plus my name. And if you haven't read, I would recommend it. It's the story of me sitting in an investment conference in London and listening to a series of presentations, including my own, and realizing, oh, my God, the same process of shifting assets out of government into private hands, often at below market prices, and shifting liabilities back in, also not with just compensation to the government. It's happening everywhere. And if you look at the model, it's the same investors. It's the same players over and over again. It's the same law firms. And realizing this was a global phenomena, a global model. If you haven't listened to John Rappaport, the interview I did with him earlier this month, it was really terrific. Because he gives you a sense of how organic and emergent the model is. And so it's a combination of one model with similar players, but it's emergent and organic and growing globally. And you'll sometimes hear me refer to it as piratization. The piratization story, or as Naomi Klein would call the shock doctrine story, starts with Greece. We continue to see tremendous amount of headlines about the spiral down in the economy in Greece, and we're watching a process where essentially what Greece needs, excuse me, I'm still getting over this cold. What Greece needs is it needs to do a currency devaluation, but it can't. It's locked into the euro, and so we see a terrible downward spiral that won't let the market adjust, a terrible deflation, and it's one that's very wealth-destroying for no purpose other than it makes it much easier to re-engineer control and assets strip the place. It's really a hit or an invasion by, you know, rather than sending the military, you engineer it through the financial system. And I've said many times before, what we don't have a financial crisis. We have a political re-engineering, and that's what you're watching. And, of course, it's very, very destructive to wealth and on the ground. Another story we see is clearly the danger. You know, I'm always laughing when you see people who are terribly afraid of the government. The problem in these kinds of situations, if you study what happened in Russia, if you study what happened in Argentina, if you study what happened in Eastern Europe, if you study this process, which has been, sort of rolling implosions globally in country after country, and now it's reaching Europe and starting with the pigs, is that your and my real problem, everyday problem, will more often be ordinary crime that occurs as people are desperate in a kind of economic implosion. And it's instructive to watch the stories of what's happening to the sort of person, whether it's a tiny village or in the middle of Athens, and what they're struggling with just to manage day to day. The numbers of bankruptcies of small business are off the charts, and of course people who thought they had strong retirement packages are discovering that in fact they're not. Now, let's turn to a story that was up on the blog. It's from Mother Jones about what's going on in Michigan. I'm just going to read you a little bit of it. We covered last year the passage of what's called, it's now called Public Act 4. It's a recent law that the new governor put in place. Let me just read you from Mother Jones again up on the blog. When the city of Pontiac, Michigan shut down its fire department last Christmas Eve, City Councilman Kermit Williams learned about it in the morning paper. Nobody reports to me anymore, Williams says. It just gets reported in the press. This is just the latest in a series of radical changes in the city where elected officials such as Williams have been replaced by a single person with unprecedented control over the city's operation and budget. Governor Rick Snyder put Louis Schimmel in charge of Pontiac last September, invoking Public Act 4, a recent law that lets the governor name appointees to take over financially troubled cities and enact drastic austerity measures. Under the law passed last March, these emergency managers can nullify labor contracts, privatize public services, sell off city property, and even dismiss elected officials. For a minute, I don't believe that it's constitutional, but where is anybody in Pontiac going to get the resources to take that case all the way up to the Supreme Court, which is part of the problem you have, particularly when these things happen initially. There continues to be, and I continue to beat this drum, one of the articles I posted up on the blog was another hit piece, this time by a Harvard law professor, on how stupid and out of date the Constitution was. And the Michigan story is a reminder of what could happen if, in fact, we do get changes in the Constitution that could make it really easy for this movement to drive a truck through the legal niceties that the courts and popular consensus still use to sort of slow this down and stop it. But it's worth reading that Mother Jones story because it's a chilling reminder of what happens if you let your town or municipality not keep its fiscal house in order. I live in a tiny town in Tennessee that has reserves of more than 10 times its annual overhead, and I assure you that's, as you've heard me say before, our mayor and city council get together once a month, and what they do is pay the bills because there's no staff, and they argue over every bill and every penny. It's quite extraordinary, and that's, I think, what it's going to take to sort of keep control at the local level. As I said before, don't worry about the presidential election this cycle. Pay a great deal of attention to the local election because that's where the war is going to come to the world that really affects you. And it's very, very important to have the right people in charge, the right sheriff if you can get them, and to make sure that you can do everything you can to help the make sure you have excellent people and excellent governance locally, because if you lose control, you're going to find yourself in the same position as Pontiac, Michigan. Another story from Raw Story up on the blog about prisons. The largest prison private prison company, Corrections Corporation of America, has sent a letter to 48 states offering to manage their prisons for the low price of $250 million per year, according to a letter obtained by the Huffington Post. What they want for that is a guarantee of 90% occupancy rate, which means they're proposing a model that requires the states to keep the prisons full, a very chilling thought. Again, it's a model issue that I covered in my story, Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits. I recommend it to you if you haven't read it. But what we're watching, whether in the Greek story, the Michigan story, or the prison story, is literally the private sector is tendering for the public sector and financing it by asset stripping, unloading liabilities, and abrogating retirement arrangements. And this is a dynamic that has been building for decades, and it's got a lot of strength behind it. So think of this as a wave, and it's going to come through all of our lives, and it's absolutely critically important that each one of us think about how we can bob and weave in this world and not get run over by this dynamic. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit out of order and touch base on my let's go to the movies now and not at the end of the Soleri Report. an absolutely sensational documentary that I just happen, sometimes I'll be trolling around Netflix and find one, and it's a flyer that I watch it. And to my very present surprise, this one was very fascinating and extremely educational. The name of the documentary is Hot Coffee. It was made last year, so it's 2011. It was directed by Susan Saladoff, who's a medical malpractice attorney of 26 years. And I think that's one of the reasons it's so well organized and documented. This is somebody who has deep knowledge of the subject. It analyzes and discusses the impact of tort reform on the United States judicial system. It premiered at Sundance in 2011 and apparently aired on HBO. As you know, I don't have a TV, so I didn't see it. The title Hot Coffee comes from a litigation that's very famous. It's called Liebeck versus McDonald Restaurants, in which the plaintiff was an elderly woman who was severely burned by coffee that was purchased from McDonald's. And it starts off with that and talks about the public relations campaign that used that very much out of context to try and instigate tort reform. One of the things it covers that is very, very informative is the is literally a campaign organized to try and sort of rejigger the elected Supreme Court officials in a variety of different states, and a campaign by the Chamber of Commerce to do that. And it tells the story of municipal Supreme Court Justice Oliver Diaz and the sort of the shenanigans around the judicial elections. And it features the very famous author from Mississippi, Griffith, who writes about legal, you know, sort of legal thrillers and mysteries. And he talks about the book he wrote that describes this dynamic. But what you see is the extraordinary effort made to get judges in place at a state level who are friendly to protecting corporations from accountability and liability through the civil justice system. One of the other cases it discusses is Jamie Lee Jones's lawsuit against Halliburton. But it's fascinating. It's very well done. And one of the things, reasons I wanted to cover it in this Solari report is it describes the limitations of liability placed by this kind of reform on the healthcare system. And it's, I think it's as we, as each one of us or each one of us on behalf of members of our family or other people we love, find ourselves navigating the healthcare system, I think it's very important to have this as background, because when you walk into a healthcare institution, whether it's a doctor's office, a hospital, a nursing home, as I've discovered, you're really navigating an institution that's dealing with very complex and tricky liability and legal issues, and it's important to remember that. So great and informative documentary, Hot Coffee. Anyway, so that's my comment on Let's Go to the Movies. What we're seeing in the market, whether it's happening in Greece, whether it's happening in the prisons, or it's happening in the federal budget, we see the administration now proposing significant increased revenues from taxation, proposing new taxes on the wealthy. It could have an important impact on investment income. Highly unlikely that anything will pass this year. So the market seems to have shrugged it off, but it's got ominous implications for next year and beyond. I talked with Franklin Sanders last week about the Congressional Budget Office annual report. It's posted at the blog. If you look at the decline in revenues, it's chilling in the face of rising deficits and, of course, the more and more people retiring and calling on Social Security. So it's extremely important that we have ways of creating liquidity on Main Street because the machinery is on to sort of take a bigger portion of total revenues and total household income in taxes to deal with the debt. I gave a speech last weekend. I spoke at the Natural Resources Conference in Palm Springs and then came back and spoke in Emeryville with a wonderful community group called, it's a combination of groups, but one is Friendly Favors. And the conversation, there was more interest in community venture funds and community currencies. Tom Greco, the wonderful community currency expert, was there. And what was supposed to be an hour presentation with an hour of questions turned into a four-hour interactive conversation that was very, very fascinating and very much like the conversation I had up in the Rogue Valley in Oregon, you know, talking about barter arrangements, community venture funds, how we start doing microequity, how we start financing small business. And you're seeing more and more really committed interest to how do we create liquidity on Main Street. So what I've told the group in Rogue Valley and Emeryville who very much wanted to follow up, that I would agree starting in March and continuing in April, I'm going to do a series of Solari reports on just this topic, community funding mechanisms. We're going to do one on the A-share, B-share model for one company because you have to understand the structure at one company before you can scale up. Then we'll do another one on community venture funds. I'm hoping to do one on community currencies, barter, and other ways to create that kind of transactional liquidity. And then, good news, Kickstarter has agreed to also do one. So we'll be talking about the Kickstarter funding mechanisms. A couple of really great stories. One's up on the blog. It's about a mayor using a flash mob. He calls it cash mob, or I guess they call it cash mob, to literally organize and shoot customers into local businesses that are struggling. It's a wonderful story of using the new technology to really make markets work in this kind of environment. Also, another great story about software developers using technology to build new markets for fresh food and small farmers. So even as we see the top-down machinery sort of tendering and trying to scarf up cash flows, we see all sorts of community and young people in response using new technology and using creativity and getting together to start to create liquidity. Very, very important. This is all good news for financial markets. So despite the bad news, equities are holding their own. The bond market is still with us despite non-existent yields. And precious metals continues to seem to enjoy support at these levels. I hate to say it, to some respects what we're describing in terms of the private sector, tendering for the public sector is bringing those cash flows into the private sector. So we would, in some respects, expect it to be good for portions of the financial markets. The administration proposing new taxes didn't seem to have much of effect. I think everybody thinks it's a next year issue. But there is no doubt that we continue to be concerned about what I call capital controls by another means. As people are beginning to focus on getting their taxes done for April 15th, again, I want you to remind you, I had my wonderful attorney, Carolyn Betts, write a update report on foreign financial institutions and compliance with provisions. If you have a foreign financial institution account, that means if you have more than $50,000 in combination, you're subject to FACTA, which is a new form that will be in your April 15th filing. If you have more than $10,000, an FBAR, I would encourage you to see that Solari report, which is just for, it'll be subscribers only for a month or two, but I really encourage you to see that because it's a very comprehensive and complete update on that. And it's extremely important if you do have a foreign financial account that you file those forms because the penalties are quite draconian. Also, we got a great question on annuities posted at the general comment spot on the blog, which another sign that the federal government and Treasury are digging in and intend to really try and build an annuity pathway very seriously. I'm going to be researching this question and hope to have something to report in the first week of March at the next Solari report. Otherwise, I'm going to hold questions tonight for our guests. So if you have questions, please make sure you post them on the webinar software because our topic tonight is one that I think has it's not simple and it's very important. My hero tonight, one of my favorite lines in one of my favorite movie, The Gladiator, Ridley Scott, for those of you who know me, you know how much I love Tony and Ridley Scott, is our hero, the protagonist, played by Russell Crowe, smiles at the guy who's about to kill him and says, "Death smiles at us all man can do is smile back." My hero tonight are the people in my life who've met death with a smile and used their approaching death and as an event that gave them permission to live life to the fullest. We all are very much in need of the wise elder. I love all the stories where, you know, the hero comes into village and what do they find? They find a wise woman or a wise medicine man. I know you all have heard me talk many times of Georgie when I in 1998, when I rented a little apartment in the first floor of her house. I thought I was in Philadelphia. I thought I got an apartment in Philadelphia just so that I could go on to the board of the school that I attended. I've been asked to join the board, and for various business reasons, I was sitting having dinner with Georgie, who at that point was in her 80s, and I realized, you know, I felt like I was talking to Yoda and was being educated in how to really live. And I realized, no, I'm not in Philadelphia for any of those business reasons. I'm here to study with Yoda. So think of the wise elder in your life and take the time over the next week or two to tell them that they are one of your heroes and to thank them, because wise elders can make a tremendous difference in our life. And their wisdom is nurtured by the sound of appreciation, is what I've discovered. So my hero is the wise elder in my life, and there are many of them, but I would ask that you say thank you to the one in your life, because truly having wise elders as we go through this period is going to make an enormous difference to all of us. So with that, I'd like to introduce our very, very special guest tonight, Joe Klein Siebuhar, and she is the author of a wonderful book on healthcare proxies and living wills. I've linked to it from the blog. She is an attorney and lives in Iowa. She also served, very important, in a very, you all know about my focus on total economic return and adding value. This was a position that adds tremendous value in society. She was chairman of the largest hospice organization in Iowa, and hospices are if you've ever been in a hospice, if you've ever had a family member need a hospice, you know what extraordinary institutions they are and what extraordinary difference they make. I had my wonderful production assistant, Mike Linton, who's a professor, very brilliant, do a search, because it's extremely important in this topic that you have somebody very well experienced at it and very clear thinking. And Mike found Joe and her book, and I read her book, and I have to tell you, it's absolutely sensational. I've looked at a lot of materials that try and cover this subject. I can't recommend it enough. It's very detailed. It's very clear thinking. This is somebody who knows a lot about this subject and has thought a lot about it and knows a lot of stories of what can go right and wrong. But it's a reminder, you know, as those of you who know me know, I've known a lot of attorneys in my life, and there's nothing more dreadful than a bad attorney, and frankly, there's nothing more wonderful than a great attorney. And if you read Joe's book, you'll know she's a very wonderful and clear-thinking, trained attorney. So with that, it's my pleasure, Joe, to welcome you to the Solari Report. Thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Oh, thank you so much, Catherine. Great to be with you. Thank you for the invitation.
Okay, so let's just start off. What is a healthcare proxy? What is a living will? What are they, and why do we care?
Well, they both come under the category of advance directives, healthcare directives. To be honest with you, there are 34 different terms that I've been able to find throughout the United States to describe these. But generally what they mean is, and they don't, let's talk for a second about what they aren't. They don't deal at all with assets. So this has nothing to do. There's always a lot of confusion about living wills and living trusts. And these advance directives have nothing to do with assets or distribution, you know, holding anything, property. These are strictly concerned with health care planning. So the two documents, and they can actually be a combination document, and many states provide for that. And I hope a little later we can talk about a form that I really recommend to people, and it's a combination form. But they're made up of two types. One is the power of attorney for health care. And the purpose for this is, Catherine, if we all like to think we're in control of our health care, and we should be. There's no question. You have to be your own advocate, number one. But there are those occasions when we are not able to manage our health care. A good example is even an outpatient surgery. If you are under anesthetic, you can't make a decision. So if someone, the doctor comes out in the waiting room and says, gosh, we found something, we need to take step two and we don't want to wake the patient up, you need somebody to make your decisions for you. So the healthcare proxy is the person that you're going to appoint in that power of attorney. So the first document is a power of attorney for healthcare. That's the appointment of a person. That also includes, that document also includes you talking about the kind of care you want. So I want to have this done. I'm okay with a respirator if it's for a short term. I'm okay with a feeding tube. You know, all that sort of thing. That's one time. So that's our power of attorney. The other document, the other advance directive then, is a living will. And a living will strictly focuses on end of life issues. Doesn't have an appointment in it. It is all about how do you want to be treated at the end of your life? What do you consider quality versus quantity? How do you define when enough is enough? So two documents, really two purposes. One is to appoint and talk about health care. The other is end of life, but they can definitely be combined into one document. It can be a combination document that covers both. So why do we care? Well, I tell you what, we need to be our own self-managers on healthcare, and if you can't, and that is a small percentage, but, you know, Catherine, we buy house insurance because our house might burn down. You know, we surely hope that it won't, and most do not, but that's why we have insurance. Well, think of this the same way. It's that small percentage of us who won't be able to manage our own care. And what do we want? We want our ideas, our own ideas on healthcare to be carried out. And the only way to do that is to appoint someone to be your advocate.
Right. And it's so important to understand that if you have these in place, then your wishes are respected as opposed to some machinery who doesn't even know you and may not care about you and are going to make it in very ways that, you know, from your point of view, are completely arbitrary and in conflict with your wishes.
Well, and all of those things, and throw into the mix that many primary physicians really are pretty ignorant on end-of-life law. I mean, I can't believe the stories that I've been told over the years by folks in audiences who will come up to me afterwards and tell me things that doctors told them and nurses told them, and they made life and death, literally, decisions for their family members based on that. You know, just a real blatant example that I like to refer to is that people need to understand they can always reverse a decision. So you can say, you know what, I want my loved one to have a respirator. Let's see how they do for a few days. If it looks like they're not going to be able to breathe on their own, then we can take it off. But I don't want to not do that now in case they're going to be able to be independent. Or the same thing with the feeding tube. They need to have nutrition built up. Many times people are told by medical professionals, whatever we do here, you got to live with it. So make your decision now. We're either going to put in a respirator or we're not. And that's simply not true. If you have the power to give it, you have the power to take it away. So that's an example and a good reason why you need to know your options, because there's a fair to mid chance that the healthcare professionals may not know what the law is and they may give you bad advice.
Right. What happened to me when I was helping Georgie through the system is literally she became kidnapped by an institution. My interpretation of their behavior was they were basically just churning her for fees. And I felt like I was trying, you know, she was incapacitated and we were just trying to get her out of there to a place that was better for her and stop a whole bunch of treatment we thought was going to make things worse. And if we hadn't, if her niece hadn't had a durable healthcare proxy, you know, we would not have been able to do that. So,
right, and you know, it go ahead.
And the other thing is we had a living will, so we were, you know, we could be very clear about what her wishes were. And even though in that instance, it you know, it wasn't always just a legal matter, it was because she had trained us. We knew what she wanted. We had very clear instructions. We knew we were authorized to deal on her behalf. And that gave us, you know, we were like two food dogs on either side of her. That gave us a power to act that was very powerful and very effective with some pretty aggressive and pushy healthcare providers in that instance.
Absolutely. And, you know, you really hit the key to it, Catherine, which is communication. The piece of paper is great. Only about 20% of adults actually have completed advanced directives. The good news is once they learn about them, so hopefully that'll apply to your subscribers here and your listeners, then about half of the people who learn about them go ahead and do them. But that piece of paper is great, but the piece of paper isn't worth much if you haven't had the conversation. So the first thing I always say is a 1-2-3 punch on this, end of life plan, communication. Talk to your loved ones. Your friend Georgie talked to you, and she talked to her niece, and you knew what she wanted. Even if you hadn't had that piece of paper, you could have carried out her wishes because you had the conversation. But when you have the piece of paper and you don't have the conversation, that's all you have. Then you become her decision maker. And, you know, that's the way a lot of conflicts in families come up, not because you're carrying out the patient's wishes, but because you end up being a substitute decision maker because they didn't. And that's
right.
Not really what is meant to happen in advanced directives. And then you delegate those proxies and you document under the law so that nobody can question your authority. But that first key was those conversations that Georgie had with you, making sure, and you know, that wasn't just one conversation when you sat down and talked to her. That was your relationship. That was you knowing her well enough to really know what she considered the difference between quality and quantity of life. And what was important in her life, how important independence was. Those are the sort of things you have to know in many conversations to really be able to step in for them. And you're just not going to cover every healthcare situation in every document or every conversation you have. So you kind of have to be prepared to know what would they do if they could still speak for themselves.
You know, I have to admit to you that I was really squeamish. I kept not wanting to do it because I kept saying, you know, Georgie, let's focus on keeping you alive. And I didn't understand the power of her, you know, of the power of doing this kind of planning and doing it among the people involved so that, you know, she could then turn and focus on being alive. You know,
you might not agree. You might not
what
agree
do you
with
mean?
That person. You might not agree
right.
with what their idea is about when they want to say enough. But if you know what it is, with a clear conscience, you can help them carry out those wishes if they're not able to. And that's really respecting that patient
right.
and the autonomy of that patient. Yeah.
One of the stories that I thought was really effective in your book is the story of Edna and her, you know, her direct or her proxy in her pocket. Could you just tell that?
Sure. Well, Edna was 87 years old, and she had witnessed, obviously, a lot of people passing in her life, and she knew for sure that she did not want to see what had happened to many of her friends, which is that lingering and, oh, my gosh, let's keep them alive at any cost. And so she made sure she executed the proper documents, and she carried with her all the time. Sure enough, Edna's out in the flower bed, and she keels over, and the EMTs find her proxy and at the hospital in the ER, just like they're supposed to. And they called the person in it, which was her nephew, and he came running in and says, you know, gosh, I had no idea that she named me as proxy. And the doctor goes, well, we have to make a decision. She is not going to survive unless we put her on a respirator. And the nephew says, oh, well, she's such a fighter. I know she put her on the respirator. And, you know, she stayed on the respirator for years before she finally passed away. She
I
named
think the book
him.
Took 6 years.
Yeah, she named him as her proxy, but she forgot to ever talk to him about it. you know, so there's that communication part again. You've got to ask that proxy, and you know they might say no, and you need to be prepared for that. Sometimes people are not comfortable with it for one reason or another. You just have to respect that. Go on to the next person, but it doesn't really do any good. It's a burden, an unfair burden on that person that you say you love and trust. To name them and not tell them that you've done that. So we're back again to the communication issue.
Right. Well, how do you determine who would be a good proxy?
You know, I think, first of all, you don't always go to the same obvious choices that you do for a lot of things. I have people tell me and when I do presentations, well, we're gonna name our daughter because she's really the alpha daughter in the family, and I know she expects us to name her, and she lives out in California, And as you said, I'm in Iowa, and I point out to them, you know, there's a lot of qualities that we want to see in an effective proxy. We want to, number one, their job is to see that your wishes are carried out. So you really have to know that they're willing to do that and trust them to do that. I've had people even say to me, you know, my husband told me he doesn't want to ever be on a respirator, but I'm telling you right now, if it's up to me, he's going to be on one. Well, that's awful. I mean, you know, there's somebody
that's
who's not respecting the patient's wishes. So you want to make sure they're trustworthy, that they're a strong advocate. As you pointed out, Catherine, sometimes you got medical people right in your face, and you really have to be able to be strong and know where you stand on the options. But the most important thing is it is, you know, I think Woody Allen said 80% of success is showing up. Availability. It really has to be someone who is going
right.
to be available to make those decisions. We can do a lot with emails, and we kind of get into the mindset that we don't have to see people face-to-face anymore. We got such great electronic communication. But, you know, if you have a loved one in a medical facility, you need to be there at 6:30 in the morning when the doctors make the rounds. And you need
right.
to find out what's going on, because you can't – who are you going to get it from? You can't go back to the nurse later and say, what did the doctor say this morning? That's not really effective advocacy. So availability,
right.
trustworthiness. And most importantly, are they willing to carry out your wishes? Are they committed to that?
Right. Now, a lot of the exact kind of proxy and living will you write, or just healthcare directives, are overseen, or it's the jurisdiction of state law. So if I'm
yes,
in a state, how do I find out what my options are within that state law?
Well, you know, it's a lot less complicated than it used to be, and that's the good news. When I wrote this book, I actually have in the print copy a chart of every single state, 51 jurisdictions, including D.C., talking about each one of them, the major, the really important aspects of their laws. You know, what do they call their advanced directives? Who's an advanced directive proxy if you don't name one? How does the law look at that? How does the law look at guardians versus proxies, that sort of thing? And there really hasn't been much change in the law, but when I did the Kindle version, and I just updated that recently, I thought, you know what, that doesn't translate well to Kindle, number one. But now we have so many great resources on the web to pop right on there. You can go to all the law sites. But the best thing, I think, Catherine, is I have a resource of a form that is accepted in 42 states. It's in 26 languages. It's a not-for-profit organization known as AgingWithDignity.org is their website, AgingWithDignity.org. You can go on there and order their form, which is 5 wishes, and I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with that. A lot of church groups, civic organizations have stepped up and distributed those to their members. And it's great because it is accepted in so many places, and it's a wonderful, crucial conversation outline. So you can not only are you getting the legality covered, and you know that it's going to be accepted, and in the 8 states that it is not accepted, then you can go and you can say, what do I need to do in my state if I'm one of those 8? Your bar association will probably have information for you, medical association. You know, the answer to the question is, do you need an attorney? I think the attorneys have answered that question themselves, because many states offer these forms on their bar association sites. So that tells you that they're saying to the consumer, you don't really need us to do this. But
okay,
this Aging with Dignity form, excuse
mm-hmm.
me, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, this 5 wishes form goes above and beyond, and that's really why I like it, because it's not just the advanced directive. It does that, but it also talks about what kind of medical treatment do you want, and it talks in very simple, common everyday terms, and it covers a lot of situations. You know, it'll say right in there, okay, you need help breathing, but your doctor says it's possible that you will recover. Do you want to have a respirator? Well, there's a real situation that you can really sit down and talk to your loved ones about and make a really informed decision. It talks about how you want to be treated. I mean, the things like, do you want hospice care? Do you want to die at home? Would you prefer to die at home? 70% of people would prefer to die at home. Only 25% of them get to, because they
right.
ask about hospice too late. Their doctor doesn't want to bring up the subject. Nobody understands it. The average stay in hospice is 3 days. Well, that's way too late. That's way too late. And I know you
And I will tell you, as somebody who's been through this, if you need a hospice, it's the most wonderful thing in the world to have one.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. And people, if they don't understand what hospice is, it is an approach to care which is not treating the underlying disease. At that point, we have said this person is terminal or has an irreversible condition. They're headed towards the end of life. Medicare defines it as 6 months or less to remaining, and that's a judgment call, obviously. If it goes past 6 months, the doctor recertifies it. But Medicare will pay for that. That's the other misnomer. People think they have to pay for that expensive care. Obviously, many people don't have those means. That's not true. Medicare will pay for hospice care, and if you require nursing care, they'll actually pay for you to be in a facility. So those are the questions you need to ask up front, and that's what I love about Five Wishes. So you can use that form. It's $5 to order this form, and if you get 24 friends to order it with you, it's $1 a piece. So, you know, you get together your church group or your book club or whomever, your office, and you order those forms, and it walks you right through it. And as I say, the only ones who really need to worry about it are the 8 states where it doesn't apply, and they can easily get information from their bar association or their medical association on what
right. Well, I'm assuming
they may be able
if
to
it doesn't
use it, but supplement.
Right. I'm assuming even if it doesn't apply, and if you're in one of those 8 states, it's still a great planning device.
Yep.
It can help walk you through the conversation.
Absolutely.
Now,
and you can use it in conjunction with the state form.
Right. I want to talk about a couple things that are in your book. One is you know, because we're talking as though this is sort of, you know, an age thing. And in fact, many, many people at very young ages become incapacitated. And one thing you cover in your book, which is very interesting, is some of the more famous cases where you get into these real food fights between the doctors, you know, different members of the family, and the whole shebang ends up in court in a huge mess.
Yeah, it's interesting that we do kind of think of this as an issue for the aging or in a final chapter of our journey in life. But in reality, the famous cases, the Nancy Krizan and the Karen Ann Quinlan and Teresa Shive, are all young women, very young women,
right,
who happen to have, you know, these awful debilitating accidents or diseases, some sort of a health issue that resulted in them being vegetative states, all 3 of them. That's why you'll find that most state laws will talk about terminal illnesses, but they'll also talk about irreversible conditions, which simply means it's not terminal. You're not going to die from being in the vegetative state, but you won't ever wake up from it, chances are. And so at some point, someone will have the legal authority to make the decision to remove feeding tube, respirator if there is one, and you will be allowed to pass away. That is not euthanasia, of course. That is simply withdrawing life support. It's interesting, Catherine, I was just finishing the book at the time of the Teresa Shive public tragedy, and actually, as awful as that appeared to all of us, the system actually did work. It took a very long time for the system to work, but all states have provisions that if you don't have advance directives, then there's state-mandated lists of people who can make decisions for you, much like people who are intestate. If you don't have a will, then the state says, okay, then your spouse gets this much, your kids get this much. It's very similar to that. The state steps in, the government steps in where we abdicate our self-determination. And in this case, they will typically start with the spouse. The spouse will be the decision maker. If there's no spouse, then we're talking adult children, and then we go on to adult siblings. But that might leave it up to people that maybe you don't want to be your decision makers, or who also may not be incapacity and able to make that decision. Those cases, every one of them was the beginning cases, the oldest cases, Krizan and Karen Ann Quinlan, were really when we were really creating the laws. These were cases of first impression for our courts. They had never dealt with this before. We had never been able to keep people alive like that before. But now we have the high
nutrition. Right, so part of it is the technology is really.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, we didn't have an issue of life support because life support didn't exist. When people couldn't eat anymore, they died. because they simply couldn't take in nutrition anymore. So once we developed those medical means, then the law had to play catch-up. The Teresa Schiavo case really was a case of an argument over whether or not she was truly in a vegetative state. She did not have an advance directive, but her husband, Michael, under Florida law, was the decision maker. And had her parents not argued that they did not believe that she was actually irreversibly in a vegetative state, he would have made the decision and we would have never known about it. It happens every day in this country. People make those, they're terrible decisions, but people make them and they have to make them and they have the legal right to make them. But that's really why it became a big public fight. And, you know, it took years. But eventually he was able to carry out his wife's wishes, which was that she not live that way. So the system did work. Sometimes those legal wheels grind slowly. But it did work, and the legal history of life prolonging measures in this country is interesting. I think it's a continuing debate. If you know the law has decided where it stands, but I'm not sure people have decided where they stand.
Okay, now you're going to laugh at me about this, but I have the most wonderful clients, and I'm always encouraging them to go through this planning process, which is why I'm so delighted to learn about your book and now Aging with Dignity Forum. But I know all of these are wonderful families. They're busy. They're creative. They're intelligent. I can see them getting the book and getting the forum. And one of them who's pushing this, try and get everybody to say, look, we want to sit down and talk about this. And everybody's saying, oh, Mom, you know, this is too gruesome. This is too hard. No. How do you get a group of people, you know, how do you get the conversation going in a way where you can really dig into all the different kinds of things? And, you know, I'm not saying turn this into a potluck dinner, but, you know, how do we get the conversation flowing so that people really understand the power of, because, you know, I've seen these things keep people alive, you know, because you had people who were trained, because they had the power and the authority, they could rock and roll for you. It made a huge difference, and it stopped a whole lot of really dangerous and stupid things, and you could navigate a system and get the machine working for you as opposed to something arbitrary happening. So I've personally felt the power of that, but how do you get a whole bunch of real busy people to take the time to and how do you get them to feel the power of that?
And, you know, it's interesting because you said it, you're very accurate in the way you said it. It is the children. 9 times out of 10, people, the older, the parents will tell me, it's my kids who don't want to talk about it. I am more than willing to talk about it. It's the kids who don't want to talk about it. I think, number one, you make it a part of your life. And I loved a couple of phrases that you used earlier when you were speaking about this topic, which is that death and you have become friends. I do think that our relationship with death is not very healthy in this country. And the more we're willing to talk about it. I'm sorry?
I tell you, one of the things, it's very interesting because I remember in 1997 I joined a church and I had, you know, I've been raised a Quaker, but Quaker meetings, you all, you know, you're silent, there's no preacher. So in 97 I joined a church and one of the things I realized was, oh my God, you know, they're talking about death. Well, I had lived, you know, between Wall Street and Washington, I'd lived in a bubble where death was not an acceptable, socially acceptable conversation.
Yeah.
And, you know, now I live in a world where we talk about it all. You know, if you live on a farm and you're dealing with livestock and, you know, it's just in the rural town, you're, you know, death is with you and you have an intimate relationship with it. But, you know, because it's a very concrete world. But I lived in the bubble. So too many of us, I know, still live in that bubble. And we haven't, you know, there's no sort of intimacy and you know, we haven't made friends with death, and we need to because it's, you know, it's the one thing. It's one thing we all share.
Exactly. And you know, I have the very closing line of my book is, what's the death rate around here? One per person. I mean, there's only one way out of here, and that's it.
Right.
And, you know, one of the wonderful parts of what happened to Teresa Schiavo was there was a huge flood of awareness of this subject. There was, unfortunately, a lot of misinformation flying around in the media, but agingwithdignity.org and sites such as that who have addressed this were flooded with requests. people really, that started the conversation. So that's where I would start. I would say anytime you have the opportunity, if you see a movie, if you read a story, talk to your loved ones about this. Bring it into your lives. Make it part of your lives. And, you know, we could laugh about the potluck idea, but whatever works is what you should do. And I do not think it's inappropriate for the parents of a family, and if the parental units may be in their 40s and they may be in their 80s, to say to their loved ones, you know what's the greatest Christmas gift you could give me, or Mother's Day gift, or birthday gift, fill in the blank. When we're all together, I'd like to take a half hour of your time. I've talked to two of the kids. I've named them as my proxy, my alternate. I want to go through the form with all of you. Then we're done with it. And as you put it so well, Catherine, then I have permission to live. Right. I've handled that part. We all go with the peace of knowing that you know what I want, and this is all I'm asking of you, is to carry out my wishes. We're not going to sit around and talk about me dying. I don't plan on going anywhere in the near future. But if you all do this for me, that would be a wonderful gift for me. I think we do have to. It's that first conversation. It's that first word that's so tough. But the more – now, I know for a fact, without even asking you, that your experience with your friend Georgie changed your attitude about dying and death for the rest of your life.
Oh, tremendously.
That privilege
yeah.
of sharing her final trip of her journey with her. It is a huge privilege. Not everyone will get that privilege. Not everyone will, and not everyone wants to experience that. But it is a reality. And, you know, ends of life can break up families. They can be the last memory you have of someone. And that's not necessarily good. If it's a source of conflict and discord in a family and watching your loved one suffer, here's a statistic for you. We're spending almost a third of our Medicare budget in the final year of the recipient's life for aggressive treatments that they don't want, they don't need, and do not add to the quality of their life. You have to talk about these things. This is a reality.
One of my favorite parts of your book, I was saying earlier when we spoke today, I use the metaphor of the Pillsbury Doughboy a lot, where you squeeze down on one place and it jumps out in another. And a lot of times we go along in our day-to-day life and we don't realize the impact that this macroeconomic event is going to have on our day-to-day life and vice versa. Yep. We don't see the connections. But you do a wonderful job of describing the demographics of the baby boomers, both in terms of need for services and then the cutback of revenues and support for services, and how we literally that's going to create a gauntlet where it makes it much trickier to get quality care. And maybe if we could just go through that big picture and what it looks like and what it means to us and why it's so important that we – you know, when we go into the system, we know how to navigate it and use the machinery to serve us, and we don't get eaten up by it.
Yeah, I always refer to the baby boomer, and I'd be one, that, you know, we're the people who are knocking at the door, and every time our culture comes to the door and opens the door, go, oh, my gosh, where did you come from? You know, and this is the same thing they said when we went to kindergarten. Oh, my gosh, where'd all these kindergartners come from? Well, those were the babies that were born 5 to 10 years ago. Oh, my gosh, where'd these high schoolers come from? Then we got to college and on and on, and look at the housing boom. And
where'd these hippies come from?
Where did these hippies come from? Why do we have the birth control bill? Why do we have the hula hoop? I mean, we have defined the culture at every stage of our lives. And this is going to be no different. This is going to be no different. And I think it is going to be interesting to see how baby boomers approach end of life. I'm not very heartened about how they're doing it so far. But
we're willing for them to become the wise elders. We're willing.
Wouldn't that be great to have 78 million of those in this country?
Yeah.
75% of the people who die every year in this country, and that's 2.4 million people die every year in America, 75% are over 65. Now, yeah, that makes sense. That absolutely makes sense because older people die. And the causes of death when you get over 65 are the types of death that are going to be more likely to be long lingering deaths. In other words, we've gotten past our accident prone stage in life and the crime, the chances of being a victim of crime, we're going to die of, you know, strokes, heart disease. those are the issues that are really going to bring this to the forefront. We only have two geriatricians, doctors who specialize in elder care, for every 10,000 Americans over 65 years of age. They can't fill these positions in the medical schools and the residencies. These young people don't want to be geriatricians. That's going to be a problem for us. We are going to have a nursing shortage. We're going to have a shortage of everything that older people need. But the biggest thing we're going to have a shortage of is an understanding of what is so, so different about that last chapter in life from the rest of it. It is a time of self-reflection. I love your phrase, Catherine, permission to live. Once you've accepted the fact that this train ride is going to end, you can really get busy on what you need to get done.
Right.
If you think it's going to last forever, there's no deadline. And I think getting older is really going to make a huge difference in a lot of people's lives as they accept it and their parents die. For many people, many baby boomers, that's their first experience with close death is their parents. And it's shocking to them to know that people actually die and they're gone. And I don't say that flippantly. I mean, that really is the first time they've experienced that. Then their friends start passing away. Then they start getting it. They start getting that there's mortality here. That we have a limited amount of time to do what we intend to be known for on this earth. So I think those resources, that's going to be one issue, but I think the cultural psychology of death is probably going to be our larger issue than even the medical resources.
Right. Although I will say this, and this is because I fret about this on behalf of subscribers and clients. You know, my family's always been very involved in health. My father was chief of surgery at a big teaching hospital. I have another uncle who's a surgeon. I have cousins who are nurses and doctors, and my grandfather was a doctor. You know, so I feel like I've been surrounded by health all my life.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've seen in the last 10 years is the same thing I see in the financial area, which is the pressure is on to generate profit, you know, and it's a drumbeat, and it makes the model crazy. And so you get I get a lot of reports from different colleagues and subscribers and investors and clients about stories where they just go into the health machinery and just crazy things go on. Because this whole machinery is on a tempo to make money and get things done, and it really has become a gauntlet. I don't know if you've ever seen the film from the I Love Lucy show of Lucy in the Chocolate Factory.
Oh yeah,
but our medical system has become like Lucy and the chocolate, and you're on the conveyor belt, and these are life and death issues, and so to me, as I read the part in your book about the demographics of both the resources and the people who are going to put pressure on the system, I realize, oh my goodness, the conveyor belt on the chocolate factory is speeding up, and we just do not want to go. Right. We don't want to go into that machinery unless we're unbelievably prepared.
That's right. For you to understand what the options are for you, Catherine, for everyone who's listening and anyone that they can influence, do they really know what a DNR is? Do they really know what it means to have a do not resuscitate? I have to tell you this quick story because it's funny, but you know it's kind of sad. This is the tattooed lady story in here in Iowa, in an Iowa town a couple years ago. Front page in the Des Moines Register. This elderly, quite elderly lady had DNR, do not resuscitate, spelled out, tattooed on her chest, she was so proud of this. Because she had had so many friends that she felt had been resuscitated when they didn't want to be, against their wishes, and had been kept alive when they didn't want to be. She wanted to make no question when those EMTs, you know, she falls down, she wants them to see that tattoo, and they're not to do anything. And everybody thought this was a great idea, and they were amused, but they also thought, well, how smart is she? Well, not that smart, because a DNR is meaningless. That EMT, comes across you and you've collapsed, he's required by law to try to revive you unless you have an out-of-hospital do not resuscitate order issued by a doctor. So you can't say, I don't want to be resuscitated. Only your doctor can say, you don't want to be resuscitated. How many people understand that? until you really grasp what your options are and you understand, and these are pretty general across the country. There's no states that don't comply with this. So this is something that, you know, is really universal no matter where you go. You've got to know what those options are. You've got to understand when hospice applies. You've got to understand what is life support. You know,
and true confession, I was halfway through your book, and I realized, you know, yes, I have a healthcare proxy, and yes, I have a living will, and now I realize they're totally inadequate, so I've got to go back and do them again.
And I told you, I'm going to send you a copy of Five Wishes, and you'll love this form, because it's very friendly. And
okay,
and
well,
really
I may get my Solari Circle and see if they'll do it with me so that we can all talk about this together. Yeah, actually,
absolutely.
You know, I have a little investment club called a Solari Circle, but our topics range far and wide, and they're just, you know, and we do it by phone, so we could even get the Solari Circle doing this by phone. I'll ask them if they'll do it with me, because I think I find in something like this you need other people to kind of think it out and help you deep breathe your way through it. Well,
you know, if you
Joe,
did it as a family. You know, if you do it day after Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the young people, anybody who has children, and I 20-something or an 80-something, they all need to be doing it. They're doing this for the sake of those that are going to have to make the decisions.
Okay, so tell us one more time, how do we find your book, how do we find the guide, and how do we keep up on your work?
Well, stop by my website, which is SoGrowsTheTree.com, and that name comes from my most recent books, which are on ethical wills, not a legal document, but I think they tie in great with healthcare directives and then, of course, the other legal documentation, last wills and testaments, because an ethical will is an ancient tradition of writing what you stand for. And I think part of the great part of this process of going through these healthcare directories is for our self-reflection, for the person who's doing it to stop and think, gee, when do I consider enough? When am I ready to say, guys, it's time for me to sign out? So really thinking about what you stand for, that's an ethical will. So that's where the name SoGrowsTheTree.com comes from. My books are available there. They're available on Amazon.com. I've got Kindle versions of my books are available as well, which is and they're very inexpensive. So, you know, you can download a Kindle version of Last Things First, just in case, for $2.99. And it's going to tell you everything you need to know. It's probably about a 2-3 hour read. And you're going to really understand.
It's beautiful. I've read it. It's beautifully, beautifully written. It's very clear.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. You know, I love stories. I always thought I was going to be a fiction writer. I always wanted to be a fiction writer. It's not in me. I'm a nonfiction writer. So I always try to spice things up with stories because it makes everything more enjoyable, and examples are always great. So they can go to my website and find that. All my email contact stuff is there, my calendar, and I do lots of workshops on ethical wills and end-of-life issues, and I'd love to talk to your listeners. Watch there, because I have a blog every day. I give little tips about how to use your value system to develop these legal documents. I think the first step to estate planning, healthcare planning, giving planning, philanthropy planning should all be, what do I stand for? You got to figure out those core values first before you do any of those legal
documents. I agree. That's great. Okay, well, Joe, again, thank you so much for joining us on the Solari Report. You have a great evening.
Oh, thank you, Catherine. Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, coming up, I'm going to be speaking at the Long Beach Health Freedom Expo on March 3rd. I'm doing a speech at noon and then a panel with George Norrie in the afternoon. And so I'll be in Southern California when I talk to you on our next Solari Report. First week of March, I'm going to be talking about living by faith. I want to get into the nuts and bolts of how we rebuild the economy on Main Street. To do that, there's some big issues that need to be dealt with and cleared. And so before you can get into doing transactions, we have to rebuild trust. And we have to talk about sort of the core principles. So I'm going to be doing that. I'll be in Burbank, so I'll be talking to you from Southern California, living by faith. And we have precious metals. I'll be in Tucson. Franklin will be back in Tennessee. And then I'll be on to Texas and Montana. It turns out I'm going to be going to Portugal later. I'm going to cycle back through California. And during March and April, I'm going to be talking about community funding mechanisms. We're going to start with the Share Be Share model for capitalizing one startup. And then on to community venture funds, Kickstarter, community currencies. Please let me know what you'd like in terms of in terms of sort of any issues you'd like to see me cover in that series. So until we meet again on talking about living by faith in the first week of March, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.